Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with Elkanah Pulitzer, who shares details about upcoming performances at the new Wilsey Opera Center space in the Veterans Building. Pianist Maria Joao Pires plays Beethoven this week at the San Francisco Symphony. I'll play you my recent interview with her. Michael Doppy from the production of She Loves Me at Foothill College is in studio to talk about their production. We'll also be talking with Cherith Pramwardhana about this weekend's Classical Revolution concerts. And Peter Robinson will be in to talk about the Marin Theater production of The Swimmers, featuring Peter Callender. Also, a review of the Pierre Bonnard exhibit at the Legion of Honor. Stay with us. I had the great pleasure of talking earlier this week with someone whom the London Telegraph calls one of the best-loved pianists in the world, Maria Joao Pires, who surprisingly makes her Davies Symphony Hall debut with Beethoven's Spirited Piano Concerto No. 2 in the San Francisco Symphony performances this week, with Anton Bruckner's Wagner-inspired and dedicated, and hence monumental, Third Symphony, also part of the program, led by conductor laureate Herbert Blomstedt. From the terrace loge of the concert hall, here's that conversation. Maria, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And happy to have you here in San Francisco, which is shockingly your San Francisco Symphony debut.
Yes, it's unbelievable, you know, especially it's a city that I know since more than 30 years because I came to visit sometimes and I never played here, and I can't tell you why, because I don't know. Never happened. So.
Well, I understand that from some articles that I've read that you didn't particularly like visiting the United States with our last president in place.
Yes, true. So I didn't come for about 12 years. And then after I started again slowly, and now I'm enjoying. Even the jet lag here is very, very huge for me. Because I came first to San Francisco as the first city. You know, I go to Canada and then I come to the States again. But I really enjoy, and I think you feel such an unbelievable atmosphere in this city, and so not only beautiful, but it's so great people, and so kind, and so nice, and so relaxed. I'm really enjoying.
Well, this is a great first stop for you then, because I understand that you're not necessarily a city person, and you must be enjoying the natural beauty here.
Yes, of course. And I did enjoy California. Two times in my life that I came to visit and I was traveling. But this time I'm more in the city. I have no time to go out.
It's a pity because of this beautiful weather that we're experiencing.
Yes, it's unbelievable. So nice.
Well, I have to first start out with what has become an internet sensation of a video that was posted a few years back of a 1999 performance that you did in Amsterdam with Ricardo Chailly, and you were to perform some Mozart, only once the concerto started, you had rehearsed a completely different concerto. I'm trying to first figure out how that's possible. I mean, did you not rehearse with Chailly at some point?
First, I must explain to you this. Was a very huge coincidence that this concert was recorded by a video, had video camera, because there was a director making a film about the Concertgebouw Orchestra. And we were together in China, and then we came back to Europe. So this concert was not planned to be with me. And I came for a replacement. And the concert, what you see on the YouTube is not the concert, it's the rehearsal, but it's public rehearsal.
Ah.
Because I came for a replacement, I didn't have a pre-rehearsal, I just had the general rehearsal.
I see.
And there was a misunderstanding with between the manager and the concert cabal about the concerto. And you know, there are many Mozart concertos. What is funny is that this is not the first time that it happened to me. Just the other times, it happened three times. The other times, it was not filmed, so nobody could see it, luckily.
What were the other times?
So difficult if you play a piece, you know, if you play a piece many times or a couple of times. And it was just a couple of months, perhaps less than a year, I had played that piece. So our memory is very selective, and we normally can, human beings, we can reproduce things quite quick if we are concentrated and if we're not too scared and if we're able to stay quiet and just remember. It's not something very special. Only I was a bit stressed, I must say, because I had the concert in the evening and I was starting thinking how much hours I have to practice for the evening. And the public was there, of course.
Right. Well, fortunately, you're a brilliant Mozartian, so that your knowledge of the other concerti came right back into mind. I need to also mention a perhaps concert mishap that I know you from, that I don't know if you'll remember this. This was in the late 1980s. One of your rare United States visits was to the New York Philharmonic. Yes. I believe it was Zubin Mehta performing.
I remember. You were there? Oh, my God. I didn't know, because I always remember that day. It was my first concert in New York, the Lincoln Center.
Yes.
And there was a lady having a how you call it?
Hearing aid.
But I couldn't recognize. I didn't know from where this sound comes. And Zubin also didn't know. And he was looking at somebody in the lodge upstairs that could help to find out. But nobody understood. And then it was exactly in the middle of the first movement, which is a very long one.
And a very quiet start to it, too. And then we hear this hearing aid in the loge.
Yes. Unbelievable. And then we had to go out. All the orchestra had to go out. They had to find the lady.
I remember it well, because I stayed in the audience and I was looking at the usher trying to explain to this woman what was going on. She was completely unaware that her hearing aid was going on.
He heard, that's what they told me after, she didn't even heard what they're saying to her. So she was really deaf.
So I'm wondering if there may be other concert mishaps that you'd like to share with us. Is this something that has happened to you before or in some other way?
Many times. Not only two or three times. But the thing is that mostly we continue playing. And, you know, sometimes somebody next to the person tells her and it stops after a while. But that day it didn't stop, so.
Any other memorable concert experiences that were not necessarily hearing aid related, but some other mishap that happened?
There are so many things, you know. In a lifetime, I don't know what to tell you now, but things like missing an airplane, arriving late for the rehearsal, crazy things. Yeah. Everything can happen, but normally everything works without problems. You know?
I think I'd be very pleased with the San Francisco audiences. They're very respectful. It'll be a very quiet hall, and you'll have a wonderful house here, I think.
I'm sure. I'm so happy to be here now. And this people are so nice here in the hall, and everybody's. It's really extremely unusual, I feel, yes.
Well, on to the Beethoven. This is Beethoven's third piano concerto. Dates from about 1800. He was 30 years old or so, maybe working on sketches prior to that. Premiered at the time of the Second Symphony, just so we have a framework of his musical style at the moment. And it's really a concerto where Beethoven becomes Beethoven. We hear him much more distinctly.
Thinking yesterday, was talking to somebody about that. It's very interesting because he has two concertos before, two concertos after. And this middle one, it's so much the growing to the real Beethoven that has no influence anymore, or I mean much, much less than from the past composers.
We still hear the Mozart and the Haydn coming on him and him in the first and second concerti, and then in the beginning of this third, there's a long introduction, almost 2 minutes of orchestral introduction before we finally hear you, which is very different from the fourth concerto.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's very, very different from the fourth, but I must say this concerto I enjoy a lot to play it. And you feel this strength, this first time, this huge strength and hope and enthusiasm. That
you'll have to forgive my musicological ignorance, in spite of my being a music major, and I play.
I'm also ignorant. Don't worry. We need musicologists are not ignorant. That's why we need them.
Good point. But the cadenzas in this Beethoven concerto, are they in Beethoven's pen, or are they your own invention?
No. Beethoven wrote the cadenzas for all his concertos, which is very comfortable because, for myself, there are many of my colleagues that like very much to compose cadenzas, which is normal, which is, for the time, was absolutely normal to improvise your own cadenza as a pianist.
Right.
But I don't like to do it, and I always feel, I mean, when such a great composer did the cadenza, so you feel very miserable if you have to do your own.
You're not a composer, you're a performer.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm very happy you wrote. Because sometimes with Mozart, there are missing cadenzas in many concertos, but this one, it's wonderful. The cadenzas of the Beethoven concertos are all absolutely amazing. In the second, you know, this so nice because it's a very late cadenza. He wrote it by the end of his life. And so it's such a contrast with the second concerto, which is very much inspired from the classic and Mozart and so. And then you hear this cadenza from the late Beethoven, full of crazy projections to the future. Mm. it's so wonderful, yeah.
This is also a concerto where Beethoven expanded the range of the piano. I'm wondering if you have a favorite piano brand that works well for you for Beethoven.
I think basically the Steinway, you mean the brand? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically the Steinway is probably the best piano to play Beethoven, for sure. Now there are some very good Bösendorfers, there are very good Faziolis that, if the special pianos, can be even better. It depends very much, you know, not only on the piano, it depends on the technicians, what they make with the piano. And this makes such a huge difference. If you have a very good technician in cities where you have very good people, or cities where you don't have very good people. So the piano is not taken care for years, so they have to change the piano and buy a new one. And the new one is always bad because it hasn't been played. So it's, you know, it's a devil's cycle for us pianists. It's always unfortunate and always difficult.
And you're not a Horowitz that you travel with your own piano.
No. I don't feel as important as that. And I'm very happy to make the effort of adapting to the instruments. It's also, you learn a lot doing that. You learn a lot of producing your own sound, you know, because many times you forget that you have to learn to produce sound with your body and not only with your hands. Mm. And adapting to a piano and making this effort in order to search for the sound you look for. It's a very good learning process.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the learning process, maybe that's what makes your workshops so wonderful, in that people respond to, even older musicians that have been teaching have been changed by your approach to workshops. What is it that you're communicating to young performers that you think is different from a standard piano workshop?
I am very busy because I have a lot of students working with me and I have lots of concerts, so I'm pretty busy. I normally don't assist so much to other workshops or master classes. Of course, the ones you know, very, very famous, like Daniel Barenboim or people. I enjoy listening to my colleagues, and I think when I have the chance. I'm looking for probably something else, because I think I'm not trying to teach. And if you have a lot of knowledge about the works, about the pieces, about the music, and you can communicate that to your students, it's wonderful. But this is something that doesn't, that they can, that information they can get anyway. So I think what is important for me is to create communication system that brings them to understand how the process starts, how they can discover music through themselves and not through what they learn. And this is a very, it's a life process, you know, because you have to first of all, forget a lot about yourself. Forget about wanting to express yourself through music, because then you have to improvise, you have to compose. But if you want to play pieces from other people, from other composers, then you have to forget yourself a lot. And this process is sometimes difficult, because you have to go through difficult moments of not wanting to be there expressing your feelings, but to try to find that, to communicate with somebody who isn't there. And this process is sometimes difficult. And I think this is my passion, to do that, you know, to bring them to that and to help them to come somehow, to prepare themselves to find a source of music. What was the source for Beethoven? From where it came? How does it come to through us then again to the public? And how can we instill this process of working? I'm not so clear.
I think you've communicated marvelously, and I think you've found that very core of Beethoven, which we're going to enjoy this weekend with the San Francisco Symphony. Please don't wait so long to come and visit us again in San Francisco, and we so look forward to having you here again.
Yes, I would wish very much to come back. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Pianist Maria João Pires there with Daniel Harding leading the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra here in San Francisco with the San Francisco Symphony this afternoon, tomorrow night, as well as Saturday night at 8, Davies Symphony Hall. Bruckner's monumental Third Symphony also on the program, conducted by conductor laureate Herbert Blomstedt. Information at sfsymphony.org. I'm David LaTulipe. It's Open Air. Still to come, you'll get a review of a couple of films from Peter Robinson, as well as a review of the Pierre Bonnard exhibit at the Legion of Honor. Cherith Premawardhana will talk about this weekend's Classical Revolution concerts. Elkana Pulitzer will talk about the Wilsey Center, Opera Center, that's now opened and atop the Veterans Building in San Francisco here. Well, turning to musical theater next with my next guest, Foothill Music Theater presents She Loves Me, the charming 1963 musical with a score by Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, a Fiddler on the Roof fame, and a book by Joe Masteroff of cabaret fame. It's through March 6th. Foothill's production will be directed by Melissa Carey with musical direction by Dolores Duran-Cefalu. Here to talk about the production is the leading man, Michael Doppy, who plays clerk George Novak. Michael is an actor, writer, director, and musician. He's been seen at a laundry list of theaters, including Center Rep Theater, Contra Costa Musical Theater, San Jose Stage, Ray of Light Theater, Pacific Coast Repertory Theater, Theater Rhino, as well as the New Conservatory Theater Center, and a number of roles with 42nd Moon Theater. It's a pleasure to welcome Michael. I think welcome him back to Open Air. Hi there.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Sure, of course. Well, this is an uber-charming musical that has quite a history, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
It started out way back in 1940 or so by this Budapest writer.
Yeah, it was written by Miklos Laszlo, or whatever the Hungarian pronunciation of that is. He wrote a play called Parfumery about these two people who are corresponding through a Lonely Hearts Club, and they're falling in love with each other over anonymously through these love letters that they're sending to each other, not knowing that they actually know each other. They work at the same shop, and in real life, in person, they can't stand each other. They absolutely hate each other, which is it's a classic romantic comedy trope that's been reused, and the story has been adapted multiple times.
One of the first film versions is considered one of the top 20 films of all time. That dates from 1940, I believe. It's The Shop Around the Corner.
Yeah, with Jimmy Stewart.
Margaret Sullivan, as well as the great Oz himself. Just the year after filming The Wizard of Oz, Frank Morgan was the shopkeeper role, Mattishek.
Yeah.
And then there was later a 1963 film adapted from this same play in the good old summertime with none other than
Judy Garland
as the leading role. Sure. So it's quite a story that has long legs.
It definitely does.
And then to have a book by Sheldon Harnick. I mean, geez, just some good stuff here.
The script is absolutely fantastic and charming, and there are some great lines, some great put downs that that my character and Amalia, which is played by Jessica Whittemore, we trade these absolutely marvelous insults back and forth, and the script is wonderful. And it's been a while since I've been able to do a musical that has such a good book. I mean, the lyrics are charming, the music is gorgeous, but to have a script that is this deep and well written, it's a gift.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gift to perform.
Indeed. Tell us a little bit about your castmates and the setting. Are you keeping it in a Budapest parfumery or?
Yes. The setting, it is in 1930s Budapest. The music sets that tone. Our set is, we've got the exterior and the inside of the shop. Everything is period. The costumes are gorgeous, and they fit us like a glove for the time period. So nothing's been updated. We're really trying to send people back to this historical time, with the staging, with the design.
You're in the Jimmy Stewart role, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is your leading lady?
Our leading lady, Jessica Whittemore. She's a local actress down in Los Altos. She's absolutely fantastic. Gorgeous soprano voice and just absolutely delightful to play off of, because most of my scenes are with her, and it's very polarized. Either I hate her or I'm falling in love with her, and so there's very little middle ground. So navigating those scenes is, if I didn't feel comfortable working with someone, it would be almost impossible. But we're having a wonderful time.
This runs through the 6th of March at the Lohman Theater in Los Altos Hills, Foothill Theater's production of She Loves Me. Tell us about your director. What is Melissa Carey done with her idea of how things should be run?
Melissa's been wonderful. She's got a vision of it, a vision of this show, and she's been working with everyone to make sure that the heart is kept with this show, because it's very easy for some musical theater performances to get into an area that's either too cheesy or too presentational, and so we're grounding everything in a very real place. It's just the volume is turned up a little bit so that our real emotions are heightened through the music and through the story and through the staging, and it's very, very funny. We've spent a lot of time in rehearsal making sure that some of these wonderfully, like, funny, specific moments are clean and focused and as funny as we can get away with.
And I imagine the challenge there must be making them fresh and funny each time.
Yes, absolutely. there's a part in the show where there are several parts in the show where George is very flustered and I've got a lot of nervous energy throughout the show through a couple of specific scenes. But there are moments where there's a scene where I'm juggling a rose that I have that I'm supposed to be bringing to this date, and I also have a letter that I have in my other hand where I'm trying to get out of the date. So the rose is what I would wear if I was at the date, and the letter is what I would give to the person to say, I'm not going to show up. So there's a moment where I'm nervous, and I keep dropping this rose and this letter, and we worked the scene for like a good day, making sure that the moments were specific. I dropped the rose at the right time. I picked up the letter at the right time, and then I handed the wrong thing off to my scene partner. And just those specific moments for comedy, I love it.
Yeah, yeah. And let's share with people that particular scene you're talking about. It's when the two finally realize, they're coming to a cafe to meet their secret pen pal that they have never seen a picture of or anything, and they realize that they're the two antagonists of the same shop.
Yeah, the scene takes place in the Café Imperial. It's a beautiful setting. Gorgeous music. There's tango dancers. It's a romantic atmosphere. That's the name of the song that's performed in the cafe. And I walk in, and she's the woman I have been corresponding with. We have arranged a meeting. She's going to have a copy of Anna Karenina on the table of her book, or on the table, and there will be a red rose in her book. And that's how I will know who this mystery woman is. And I will have a red rose in my buttonhole. And so I walk into the cafe, I see the book, I see the rose, I see the woman, and when I recognize that I know this person and I hate this person, I'm in on the secret and she isn't. So we have a scene where I'm trying to get more information, trying to find out, are you really this person? Who are you waiting for? What's this book for? And I'm absolutely awful to her. Just absolutely terrible. I talk about how lonely it is for somebody to be meeting up with a stranger, even though that I'm the stranger who would have been at the table. It's it's a wonderful scene, and the mystery of I know the information and she doesn't, it's a lot of fun to play off of.
She Loves Me is at Foothill Music Theater through the 6th. Tell me about you mentioned there's some tango dancing, tango music going on. What is the band, the ensemble that you have?
We've got a wonderful group of a wonderful cast, wonderful group. We've got the people who work in the shop, and so that's Mr. Marichak, the boss, Mr. Sipos, Miss Ritter. We've got Arpad, who's a kind of a younger helper. He's like a teenage boy who's helps out in the shop, and then we've got an ensemble of I think maybe a dozen people who are customers at the shop, people who are at the cafe, dancers, and they're all wonderful, wonderful performers, wonderful dancers, gorgeous voices.
I didn't realize that there was a 1977 revival on Broadway that starred Madeline Kahn as the leading lady. And it's actually going to be mounted at Studio 54 by Roundabout.
Yeah, Roundabout Theater. They're mounting a new production. Zachary Levi, who is in Chuck, he's going to be playing George, which is a role that I'm playing. It's absolutely fantastic cast. And this show, whenever there is a revival mounted, they get absolutely fantastic people. People want to come out to do this show, because they're such great characters and great songs.
Well, I hope you have a great production of it. That's Michael Doppy, featured as George Novak in the Foothills production of She Loves Me through March 6th. You've got one of the catchiest tunes in the whole darn show, which we're going to hear now going out from the original 1963 Broadway cast that included Barbara Cook and Jack Cassidy, who won the Tony for 1964 for his role. Here's Daniel Massey in your role singing She Loves Me. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it. Knowing that she loves me, she loves me. True, she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah! Now today she likes me, ha! And tomorrow, my teeth ache from the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now. Before my love discovers that she and I are lovers, imagine how surprised she's bound to be. She loves me. She loves me. I love her. Isn't that a wonder? I wonder why I didn't want her. I want her, that's the thing that matters. And matters are improving daily. Yesterday I loathed her, now today I love her. Woo! And tomorrow, tomorrow, oh, I'm tingling, such delicious tingles. I'm trembling, what the hell does that mean? I'm freezing, that's because it's cold out. But still I'm incandescent, and like some adolescent, I'd like to scrawl on every wall I see. She loves me. She loves me.
Daniel Massey singing She Loves Me. You'll hear Michael Doppy singing that very tune at the Lohman Theater, Foothill College production, the Foothill Theater production of She Loves Me. Score by Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnack, and a book by Joe Masteroff of Cabaret fame. Some great tunes, great fun. It was the musical that was inspired by early on the wonderful movie The Shop Around the Corner, which featured Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, and the 1949 Judy Garland musical In the Good Old Summertime. Now through March 6th, information at foothillmusicals.com. Well, at long last, work has been completed on the Diane Wilsey Center for Opera The fourth floor of the War Memorial of the Veterans building was originally designed as a museum and was home of SF MoMA for 60 years, from its founding in 1935 until they moved to SOMA in 1995. It's now consolidating a number of San Francisco opera departments that were scattered throughout the city and includes the Taube Atrium Theater, an education studio, exhibit galleries, the San Francisco Opera Archives, administrative offices, costume studio, and support spaces on the fourth floor. Combined with basement storage, the center now has some 38,000 square feet in very close proximity to the Opera House, just across the alley, in fact, and will surely be the lasting legacy of outgoing San Francisco Opera General Director David Gockley. Thanks, of course, to the millions donated by D.D. Wilsey. Recently, I visited the center and talked with Elkanah Pulitzer, who is in charge of the special programs and presentations that will be taking place in the Taube Atrium Theater. Here's that conversation. Elkanah, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you mind my starting with a question about your last name? Is Elkanah Pulitzer? Pulitzer, is that part of the Pulitzer family?
Indeed, yes, it is. My father was Joseph Pulitzer IV and the fourth generation of Pulitzers who have been deeply involved in the journalism industry.
Was that ever attractive for you for a career, or did you more think of the humanities and arts in your professional life?
Well, as a kid, I found it daunting to write thank you cards for gifts from my grandparents because I always wanted to use a really great vocabulary. But I've always been in love with the performing arts ever since I was a young child and have pretty much pursued it since the beginning.
Well, that background's coming in handy for the events that are happening as part of the SF Opera Lab, and that you can use some of your fine arts background to offer some insight for some pre-concert talks and inviting some folks that are peripheral to the concerts that are going on.
Absolutely. We are launching a new venue, the Taube Atrium, and it's right in the heart of the Arts District in downtown. And as part of that, we're essentially loading in risers, hanging lights, putting up projectors, and we're going to be using this brand new space for the first time. And with that comes, of course, unknowns and things that need to be kind of smoothed over and debugged. And so we're having some soft opening activities within the next few weeks in order to kind of test all the systems and get everything up and running before we start flowing significant groups of people through the space to make sure that it's really welcoming for them when they get here.
Well, the first major production for the Taube Atrium Theater, a beautiful, intimate space, by the way, you can bring your cocktail in from the lobby, is going to be a production of Franz Schubert's Die Winterreise, sung by the incredible Matthias Gorn with Marcus Hinterhauser on piano. Tell us a little bit about this production. It's quite a visually striking thing that's going to be happening, isn't it?
Indeed, yes, it is. It's designed and directed by William Kentridge, who is a fantastic fine artist. In fact, his work has been shown in the United States significantly for many years. And this piece is about his resonances and connections with the poetry and the music of Schubert, and it's just striking, really. So I have to say that one of the programmatic interests that we have with the lab is to offer programming that is sort of a confluence between different forms, and so this sort of intersection between fine art and poetry and great song is, again, a wonderful example of what we're trying to do here.
This production originated in July of 2014 at the Aix-en-Provence Festival. And the pianist I mentioned, Marcus Hinterhauser, is the new artistic director of the Salzburg Festival. I'm wondering, are there some necessary tweaking to the production that's going to have to happen once they come on site?
Interesting question. You know, again, they'll be the first production that we'll host here, and so we will learn as we go. But I think that this kind of intimate scale that seats 299, which brings the audience really close to the performers, will really be a perfect space for this kind of project, which is why we picked it.
After the Winterreise in April for, it looks like, 7 performances, Anna Sokolovich, chamber opera for 6 women. Tell us about that production.
That's called Svadba Wedding, and it's a piece that originated in Toronto at Queen of Puddings and has been done at Opera Philadelphia as well, and coincidentally also last summer at Aix-en-Provence. It's a beautiful piece for 6 women that essentially celebrates and ritualizes the preparations for one woman's wedding, and it really takes place in the hours before that wedding and is really about the more private female spaces and emotional journey that they take and support one another in to get ready for this wedding.
Chamber music heading audience's way in early April, where we'll be able to feature members of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. Amazing group of musicians there. You're lucky to be working with them.
It's been really incredible to get to know them, and one of the things I'm really excited for is that these are curated by the musicians, and that there'll always be a sort of behind-the-curtains aspect to the presentation whereby the musicians get to talk about the selection and their resonances with a particular piece or any memories or associations or why a particular composer. So it really does lift the veil compared to being a part of a very large orchestra in the pit, where if you go up in the main house, it sort of feels like you might not want to wave across that barrier. In this context, I think we really get to have a much more intimate connection with them.
I'm very excited to see that you'll be doing the Triplets of Belleville in concert. That wonderful when was the film? Do you recall?
I think it was 2008, if I remember correctly. I remember seeing it in the theater and just loving it. And I'm thrilled with this. It's a great movie. It was nominated for an Oscar. And it's a silent film, and so it will have live Foley, jazz, and chanteuse in terms of the accompaniment. And that's, again, something that I've always loved is just, you know, live Foley, which is kind of comes out of the radio tradition, watching people make those sound effects and, you know, crunching shoes on a gravel box. And there's actually a bicycle that is part of the soundscape for the piece because bicycles play a part in the story as well. So it's just charming.
And that's with composer-conductor Benoît Charest leading the Le Terrible Orchestre de Belleville, along with a crew of sound effects people.
Mais oui!
And the incredible Deborah Voigt is coming in May to give the very cleverly titled Voigt Lessons on May 6th and 8th.
That's right, written by Terrence McNally, who, you know, obviously has a huge number of great plays that he's done. And Kevin Stites is the music director, who is a big part of Broadway and Radio City Music Hall. So it's really, I think, going to be a fun night. I mean, she sings about between 10 and 15 songs, some of them torch, and really, again, lifts the veil on the life of a huge, famous opera singer and talks a bit more about what it means to be in this profession, on stage and off.
Well, this is just the first season for SF Opera Lab. I know for major opera stars, they're booking things 5 and 10 years down the road. How far in advance are you able to look ahead for next season?
That's a great question. I think that part of what the lab represents, SF Opera Lab for San Francisco Opera, is a real chance to be an R&D venue to kind of, and programming, to really create a nimble, lithe, flexible situation where we can test ideas, cultivate new partnerships and new talent, and expand our audiences. So really, I think that we want to be able to program on a shorter timeline.
keep the spontaneity factor going there. Well, we look forward to talking with you more down the season and to see what's happening in the next season. More information at sfoperalab.com.
I also just wanted to mention that we do have a few titles for our second season that are already rolling out. We'll be doing The Source by Ted Hearn, who has been featured at San Francisco Symphony and Soundbox and has commissions from many of the great symphonies in the United States, and he's a real hot up-and-coming composer. And we're also doing La Voix with Anna Caterina Antonacci, and very excited about that project as well.
Well, keep aware of what's happening at the Opera Lab at sfoperalab.com. Elkanah Pulitzer, thanks for taking some time today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Speaking of a new way of doing things, not only at the Opera Lab at the San Francisco Opera, but a classical revolution has been going on for some time here, starting in San Francisco and founded by Cherith Premowardhana, who joins me in studio to give an update of what's happening for this, their 10-year anniversary season. Cherith, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you, David. Great to be here today.
Well, this Saturday is going to be quite an event, combining some Beethoven and Bowie.
That's correct. We thought, you know, celebrating our 10 years, we thought, how do we do this? And we have these two figures who are pinnacles of musical creative creation and very revolutionary figures from different time periods. But the thing about Bowie is he has such lush orchestration in a lot of his recordings. So we thought it would be great to feature this music alongside Beethoven with our orchestra, and this is the first year we're putting on a series of orchestra concerts.
Mm-hmm. And this, the organization as it is, the Classical Revolution, has over 30 chapters now around the country, and you're even expanding internationally now, aren't you?
That's right. We've been expanding internationally for a few years. There's been active chapters in Berlin and Paris and Amsterdam, as well as in Korea and Australia.
Oh my gosh! Is it like a Burger King franchise? You know, someone comes up and say, "I want a Classical Revolution franchise."
It is, but it's similar. Our Whopper is not going to taste the same wherever you go to. So each chapter has their own way of doing things and their own set of musicians. Some chapters are more wind heavy, so have a lot of wind quintets, and a lot of the chapters are string heavy, so there's a lot of string quartets and things like that.
Hold the pickle, hold the lettuce, hold the violin.
Yeah, so you got, you know, your different varieties of the sandwich, no matter, depending on where you're going.
Well, you've got a great new venue here in San Francisco. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's an excellent venue. They're just starting a music series. It's called the Folsom Street Foundry, and we thought this would be a perfect venue for our 30-piece orchestra to begin our series. And the venue holds 400 people, so we're looking forward to an exciting event on Saturday. Tall ceilings, it's an old venue, and they have a full bar. It's a 21 and over event, and they also have a food menu, so it should be a nice evening for everybody.
That's this coming Saturday at the Folsom Street Foundry, February 27th. Doors open at 7, the show's at 8. And Monday nights, you guys are still doing stuff at the Revolution Cafe, right?
That's right. That's our home venue. We took our name, Classical Revolution, from the Revolution Cafe, which is in the Mission District on 22nd Street, and we still play there every week on Monday nights. And that's always a mix of music. You know, we like to represent a nice cross-section of our musical community here in the Bay Area. So we do a lot of string quartets and string chamber music in general, but we include wind sometimes, and we need to still get David to come and play some flute quartets with us.
Absolutely. I'm on your short list. I know that.
Yeah.
I'll have to do it. ClassicalRevolution.org about this Saturday's and their other events. Congratulations on 10 years. Let's hear some of that revolutionary music to go out. What are we going to hear, Cherith?
Oh, this is just a track from David Bowie. We'll be performing this with... Also, I should mention that we have different guests singers on this concert. So this song will be performed by a great young singer who's new on the scene named Maya Fagina. But her mother actually happens to be the pianist of the San Francisco Ballet, so there's some tie in there.
Nice.
And so she'll be performing the song. We also have Stephen Jenkins, who's the lead singer of a band who I'm not allowed to mention, who will be singing as well.
Well,
you can look up Stephen Jenkins.
All the details at classicalrevolution.org.
Moon Age Daydream.
Hit it.
I'm a mama, papa, coming for you. I'm a space invader. I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you. Keep your mouth shut. You're smoking like a big monkey bird. And I'm busting up my brains for you.
Beethoven and Bowie, part of Classical Revolution, this Saturday at the Folsom Street Foundry. More information at classicalrevolution.org. David LaTulieb concluding Open Air for this week with our good friend and regular commentator, Peter Robinson, who on Renoir's birthday, by the way, is going to talk about Pierre Bonnard.
Yes, indeed. And just talking about space invaders, Pierre Bonnard indeed has invaded the space at the Palace of the Legion of Honor. And this is just a remarkable exhibition. It's the first time they've presented a full show in almost half a century. So anybody looking for that transitional period that takes you from the Impressionists at the end of the 19th century to, in fact, he died in 1947, will get a good, solid introduction and revelation about some of his great masterpieces. Now, there are over 70 different exhibits in this particular show, so you get a good broad section, and they've got some of the classic ones which have come from the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. Other museums have contributed. And I think one of the things which I came out with were his bright colours, because he did spend time down in the south of France, living on the coast down there, and he had a house at Le Canet. So, again, he gives you both the inside and the outside of the house. The light comes in and it illuminates his pictures. The other thing which I think is interesting about Pierre Bonnard is that he was interested in theatre, and he actually did some set designs. And I think when you're a set designer, you're already telling the story about the stage before the actors come on. So some of his pictures, which really begin the story, the characters come in. There are other kind of, they're very close to still life. There's one where a white cat is looking you in the eye and you feel it's about to pounce or jump. So he is that interesting transition period from the Impressionists down to modernism. He worked from photography. He did do set designs. He also finished up in the huge poster advertising area. So you've got plenty to look at. And I'd highly recommend taking an audio tour. The headphones will guide you from painting to painting. And if you're looking to go with a friend and having a chat after the exhibition, the cafe up at the Legion is a excellent place to review exactly what you have seen.
A little taste of the Bonnard exhibit, as well as information about ours, is at the Legion of Honor website, which is legionofhonor.famsf.org.
And it runs through the month of March, so there are many opportunities to go up and see it.
Movie time, Peter.
Movie time indeed, and by contrast, the invasion of Europe, another European, but this time where to invade next, and I think it's Michael Moore definitely at his best. He goes through different European countries, also includes Tunisia, and he looks at the prison systems, he looks at the school systems, he looks at the hospitals, he looks at the way people treat drug addiction. And I think it's a very revealing, it is cherry-picked, about how life, he would put it, is good in Europe. It's a cri de coeur. He wants to make a point. One interesting section, since this is a radio station that broadcasts lunchtime menus on a regular basis, in France, you have a two-hour lunch, a five-course meal, a gourmet chef, and that's just for the everyday students. That's not in the high-end private schools. So he is definitely out to make a point. He finishes up in Iceland. He points out that the only bank that didn't go bankrupt was run by women. And in Finland, when exploring the school system, he's quick to explain that they have no homework. Sweden, of course, has got one of the highest records in terms of educational proficiency in the world. Now, Michael Moore is still his jolly self. A little overweight, a little disheveled. Some of those memories of the 60s come alive when he points out how far speed takes, and he ends up at the Berlin Wall, which, as we all know, came down overnight. And he makes references in Germany particularly how the Nazi past is taught in the classroom, so people are made conscious of it. And of course, he raises the question, do we do the same for slavery in this country? Now, while there's a polemic to his travel log, I think what one is made aware of is that he is interested in looking at the nature of lifestyles. And here, of course, in happy Northern California, where the sun is shining and we think all is well, he gives us food for thought. But I think he also gives us fuel for action, because he goes on to point out that many of these innovations actually originated in this country, but they have been brushed aside. And he looks at issues such as freedom of expression, ways to read and write history. And I think it's a good historical piece of travel logging where you discover aspects of Europe, whether it's in Sweden, whether it's in Finland, Portugal, for example. You are not imprisoned for having drugs. The police go and make a point out of this, nor is there any death penalty. So it's a provocative film. It's a film which will make you smile, it'll entertain, it'll educate. And I think in many ways, Michael Moore has, but I want to say matured, he's not quite in your face the way some of the early documentaries are. I highly recommend it. It's screening in different places. It's called Where to Invade Next.
Here in San Francisco at the Alamo Draft House and in the Cal 3 in Berkeley.
And
your other movie...
Marin in Sequoia.
Ah, excellent. The other movie is The Lady in the Van, which we heard about from yesterday's Fresh Air from the lady herself, Maggie Smith.
Well, I think Maggie Smith holds the film together. It's not exactly a new film. This was a play written over 10 years ago by that great playwright Alan Bennett. And it's not Maggie Smith also of Downton Abbey. This time she is a homeless person, and as the title suggests, she's living in a van. The story, she used to be a pianist in this particular movie, and now she's on welfare, and in fact ends up living in the van on the actual garage runway to Alan Bennett's house. I want to say it's not a great film. I'm not giving it a negative review because it all depends on Maggie Smith's acting, which of course is first rate. But there's not a lot of new ideas. And people who've read his early plays, read his memoirs, may say, well, when was this written? And the quick answer is it was written more or less over 15 years ago. Interesting if you like Maggie Smith. Interesting if you want to see Maggie Smith not playing a duchess. Yes. Where does she live? Not in a house, not in a country house, not in a castle. She lives in a van.
And not an abbey in an alley, rather.
That's right.
More driveway.
That's right.
Well, here in San Francisco, it's at the Embarcadero Center, among other places, I'm sure, to be at the Tiburon Playhouse 3. Peter, thanks so much for coming in today and for sharing your brief synopses of some interesting cultural events that are happening, including the Bonar. I can't wait to see that exhibit.
That's a great exhibition, David. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Peter. Open Air is produced by Niels Swinkels. Our programs are archived at kalw.org. And if you got a segment you'd like to share, some cultural institution here in the Bay Area, happy to have them on. Send me an email, david@kalw.org, and we'll be in touch with them. Thanks for listening.